Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue. Wednesday hump day. All right, a little bit of a treat. We'll go long today. So those of you that are working, got a little another hour of All Marine Radio. Hopefully that fits into your schedule. If it doesn't, you'll hear part of an interview with General Anthony Zinni, the Burning Bush, as I call him, because he's all that, trust me. And so if you've never heard the interview, sit back, relax, and enjoy it. If you have heard it, you're in for, obviously, a treat. So having said that, we did this interview, lined it up with him, and he's been one of my heroes since 1989 when I heard him speak. Literally, I'd never heard a guy like this in my Marine Corps career. And he was truly all that. He could talk it. He could talk to any group of Marines, from PFC Lance Corporal to obviously General Officer, and he could hold sway with them. Intellectually, a gigantic guy. Physically, formidable, imposing guy. A combat veteran, a leader, great sense of humor, all of that. So got a chance to interview him. And I didn't know how long he was going to be able to stay, so I just kept going until he said something. And because you don't get a chance that many times to interview guys like Tony Zinni, and so it was truly a treat for me to go ahead and to do that. So, and then what did we cover? We covered his career. We covered his thoughts on Afghanistan, on Iraq. We cover his thoughts on Don Rumsfeld, and to his incredible credit, you know, a lot of times guys of his status, when you have them on, they get very politically correct and all that. He's the same guy that I heard in 1989. He's frank, and comes across like that. So, without any further ado, the Burning Bush himself, a self-advertised guinea from Philly, Anthony Zinni, and you'll hear his combat concepts stuff in the next couple weeks. But that's how I first heard him, and here on a special edition of All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, one of the best of interviews we've ever done.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me now is the Burning Bush himself, General Tony Zinni. Sir, first of all, thank you very much for coming on and doing this. I really appreciate it.
All right.
So do you think there's, like, stand-up comedian in your blood? Or because that, I'll tell you what, I didn't even know who the hell you were that night. And went there, and that little discussion, that little display, combination of stand-up comedian, guy who's obviously read a lot, and your combat experience, and you weren't afraid to call bullshit on the institution, changed a lot of lives for me and my peers that were back there instructing. So where did all that come from?
Well, you know, it all goes back to being a young lieutenant and captain in Vietnam and watching what went on. And seeing the price that our troops pay for stupid mistakes and illogical doctrine and bad strategic decisions. And I think after a while, you just feel you have to say something. And I began, and I was really fortunate because I worked for bosses that wanted to hear your voice, whether what you said was something they were going to like or not. But, I worked through the years with some great people like Al Gray and a number of others that just wanted to hear people that saw it differently and took it into account. And I was blessed that way, I think, and that's what encouraged me to do it.
All right. We're going to start the actual interview here in a second. I mean, we're doing this, but does General Gray get enough credit for the intellectual life that he blew back into the Marine Corps?
No, not at all, which really disappoints me. I really thought after his retirement, his legacy was so great because he changed our thinking of, there was a renaissance in the operational art, the way we began talking about war fighting. Frank frankly, it didn't continue as much as I wished it would. And he didn't get the credit, as you alluded to afterward, for initiating that.
My guest this morning is Tony Zinni, and we're going to find out about him so we can decide if we should take him seriously on All Marine Radio here. So, sir, first, born and raised where?
Philadelphia, right in the outskirts of the city.
All right. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, when I was the last kid in my family, the only one who went to college, and I was a commuter student. I knew nothing about college. Somebody told me when I got there you had to join the military while you were in school. I didn't know that that wasn't true. And one day, walking to the cafeteria, totally confused and trying to understand what an elective was and everything else, I saw three Marines in their dress blues standing in front of some posters. I thought it was the place you signed up for your next class. So they looked good. And I walked up and said, where do I sign? And they said, sign for what? I said, well, whatever you got here. Well, what they had was the platoon leader's course, PLC. I signed up and then realized I was going away for the summers at Quantico. And I just loved it. It clicked. It just seemed right. And then after graduation, get commissioned, go to basic school. Then while in basic school, Marines go into Santo Domingo. Marines go in big numbers into Vietnam, and it just was an exciting time.
But no other Marines in your family? It just
long line. Well, I had a brother-in-law that was in the Marine Corps. My father was in World War One. My parents were immigrants to the country. Not long after he came, he was drafted in the U.S. Army. Went to France. My brother was in the Korean War. Cousins in World War Two. So all the male members of my family were, you know, Army, Air Force, drafted during wartime and saw combat. So, you know, it seemed natural.
All right. So that's how you get to the Marine Corps. What about, give me a couple, and I'm going to restrict you to two. Give me two guys who, or women, whoever, who had major influences on you as a Marine leader.
Well, I would say first and foremost was General Al Gray, who I knew from the time I was a young company grade officer. And, you know, Al Gray had a great following. And if you were one of his puppies, if he thought you had something to say, you thought about things operational, you were on his team. And the other I would say was General Traynor, Dick Traynor, who was my battalion commander in Vietnam, my second tour as a company commander. Both of those seemed to me to be all about our profession of arms more than anybody else I knew. I had others that were good too, but those two probably had the greatest influence on me.
All right, give me a couple people. Your career outside the Marine Corps has been just as impressive as what you did on active duty, and you've continued to be a national figure. So who influenced you relative to things outside the Marine Corps? The discussion about national strategy and all the application of military power as it is. Give me a couple of people that had a huge impact on you relative to that.
Well, someone who was in the military but also was outside and influential was Colin Powell. Mm-hmm. He had asked me to do several missions. One was the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Another was a peace process with the Indonesian government and one of the rebel groups on Sumatra. And his deputy, Rich Armitage, who I worked with when I was in the European command, and Ambassador Armitage was working the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Empire and trying to connect to the Russians and the former Soviet republics. And both of those taught me a lot about the military power, but also important, the non-military power, the soft power potential of our economic wherewithal, our diplomatic wherewithal. And since both had strong military backgrounds, I saw the importance of the connectivity and the integration. I mean, it just seemed like we were one-punch fighters strategically through the military at everything. And the other elements of power in our government were never applied the right way. And I think we've seen a repeat of that in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We'll get to that in a few minutes. I want to talk about your combat tours. Give me, if you'll walk us through, give me one or two great lessons from every one of your combat tours, starting in Vietnam?
Yeah. Well, my first tour in Vietnam as a lieutenant, I went over as a lieutenant, was as an advisor to the Vietnamese Marine Corps. And we had two officers in every Marine battalion. Vietnamese Marines were good fighters. The units were small. They were the National Strike Force, so they went all over Vietnam. And basically, what I got out of that tour was the ability to watch and see young officers, company grade officers, Vietnamese Marines in combat, a whole number of them. I was out with the companies and platoons mostly. And so you had the, I guess, advantage of not being in command, but being right next to that commander as advisors. You know, we called in American air support, logistics support, and obviously they didn't need much advice on how to fight at the tactical level. And as a young lieutenant, I was learning more than I was passing on.
Right.
And I think what I took away from that tour, when I got back to Quantico and went to basic school as an instructor, I saw a different war than my counterparts saw up in the 1st and 3rd Marine Divisions. First of all, I saw the whole country, saw the war from the Delta to the DMZ, and saw the differences. But I also saw it from the eyes of the people. We, the Vietnamese Marines, by law, there was a quartering act. We moved into the houses of the villagers when we were in villages. And you really got a sense of how the people were viewing this, the fighting and what was going on. And it was totally different than I think what we were selling or believing. So this sort of connection to the people. My second tour was a company commander, Alpha 1-5, and at that time 1-5 was called the Pacifiers. We were the division strike force, and we deployed on enemy sightings, downed helicopters, that sort of thing. Had a very large company, about 250 Marines,
wow.
All kinds of experimental weapons. We had the experimental flamethrowers, the first automatic grenade launchers, and you know, extra machine guns. So it was a really powerful organization for each of our companies. And so you know, it was toward the end of the war in 1970, at least our involvement. But there was some pretty strong contact. I was wounded and evacuated as we took a hill. We had a prisoner, a North Vietnamese intelligence officer that led us into his headquarters. And that sort of, I think, gave me the ability to see the war as my counterpart saw it from inside a U.S. unit, and then sort of try to square what I saw as an advisor and what I went to Army Special Warfare School before the advisory tour. I went to they had a high-intensity language course there, so I could speak the language. We wore the uniforms of the Vietnamese Marines. So those were two, I thought, great perspectives. Other combat tours, I did three tours in Somalia. During a desert storm, I was up north with the Kurds and was in Israel, and we put the Patriot missiles in. And, of course, at CENTCOM, a number of the operations that we launched against Saddam and, you know, and elsewhere, European Command, some of the evacuations we did. That's kind of the experience in short.
Give me one lesson from Somalia.
Well, I think that the big lesson from Somalia is we went in, you have to remember President Bush, 41, committed us into Somalia after he lost the election. And he did it out of the purest of humanitarian motivations. He really saw the devastation, hundreds of thousands of Somalis starving, the NGOs and the UN could not get food and water to them. So he launched us in there, what we thought was going to be a very short operation, just to secure the environment, and the UN would pick up from there. The UN did not pick up from there. I remember President Bush came out to see us. It was his last trip before the inauguration. And we had asked him, what's the plan? Where do we go from here? When does the UN take over? And there was no plan. It was clear. We were launched, again, for all the great humanitarian reasons that you could imagine, but there was no strategy. There was no, people like to say end state, I don't like that term, but there were no political objectives, there was no way of looking at how this thing would pan out in the future, and kind of the Colin Powell pottery barn, you know, you break it, you own it, you touch it, you own it in these environments, and we own Somalia. And so I think the greatest lesson that came out of there for our involvement is the way we went in, again, the lack of what I think we've seen ever since the end of the Cold War is a lack of strategic thinking and the ability to act strategically. We've been sort of fumbling around ever since.
We'll get to that, too.
Okay.
Give me a is Desert Storm an anomaly in modern warfare in terms of can it, I don't know that it could get closer to attacks in terms of and the cleanliness that that thing went with. Give me a lesson from Desert Storm.
Well, I think what we saw in Desert Storm was the tremendous power that conventional force that we had developed. And how superior it had become over Soviet capabilities. I was in Europe when Desert Storms went down. And, of course, European Command had parts of the war up in northern Iraq and Israel and other places, and then follow-on operations like Provide Comfort with the Kurds. So we were involved in it. We saw it from that end. One thing that was going on at the same time is we were beginning to create relationships with the Eastern Europeans formerly under Soviet control and in Russia and elsewhere. And when I was going around to some of the Eastern European war colleges, we were meeting with Soviet general officers in order to create a military-to-military relationship. They were awed by what happened in Desert Storm. They could not believe, literally, and they're very open about it, how superior our tactics, our operational thinking, our weapons systems had were over theirs. And it was a CAC. So, you know, we had thought through the deep battle, air-land battle, all those things that, that led to how we fought in space and time much differently than the Soviets, a much greater delegation of decision-making, much more input from the bottom up, which is totally alien to their system. So I think we kind of walked off as the Cold War ended with sort of an exclamation point. And that was Desert Storm proved that something gone down in the fold the gap, we were more than capable and could have handled it. The trouble I saw from being out in European Command when the wall came down is it just seemed like everything broke loose. And everybody assumed this was going to be a peace dividend. It was going to be a new world order, and it was going to happen automatically. But what I could see from down on the ground is the Deputy Director of Operations for the European Command, it was letting loose a whole series of things that we didn't understand, which was going to lead to a very different and confused world. And for some reason, we stopped thinking strategically. You know, where we thought about deterrence and containment during this, the Cold War, it was like we didn't need to do that anymore. I mean, I've heard people, current administration, talking about, I don't need the Kennans anymore. And the lack of, we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan a horrible, well, lack of decision, strategic decision making as opposed to even having a strategy. And that's what bothered me. And so for 25 years we've seemed to be in drift in this case. And Desert Storm might have been the last point at which we sort of ended an era in strategic thinking, started a new reordering of the world, much as we did after World War I and after World War II, but we didn't know how to handle this reordering.
CENTCOM, give me a lesson learned from your time at CENTCOM.
Well, the biggest lesson I took away from CENTCOM is that was, and it could be from any regional command, but maybe most important out there, is you really got to dig in and understand and know the culture. Just a little anecdote. When I was the CENTCOM commander, George Tenet, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, called me up and he said, Tony, I want to come down and talk to you and get some briefings from you. And I said, George, what am I going to brief you on? You see all the intelligence. You have the greatest analysts in the world. He said, you know, I see the intelligence. I get the analysis. I don't have context. He said, I want to see your part of the world from your eyes. And when he came down, I knew what he was talking about because people see the facts. They get the data. They can even see the analysis done, you know, kind of in a vacuum inside the beltway. But if, what I told George when he came down, I said, George, if you don't really understand Islam, if you don't understand the desert, if you haven't lived in it, been in it because it shapes the way people think out here, you know, if you don't understand the critical history, which was the post-Ottoman Empire and the effects of colonization, I mean, these are things that give you context and allow you to understand how people think out here and why they do what they do, and more importantly, to understand the fact that we have a region of the world that's undergoing a tremendous transformation right now. Some are getting through it and some are not. And you've got to think of it in that context, or else you're just reduced to tactical actions, maybe operational, but you're not thinking deeper about this in a much more strategic way.
I've got an email for you. And then I want to talk about the role of the chaplain in combat, because listening to you, to your comments, you know, brings that back. I mean, our chaplain, my last combat tour was in Afghanistan. He was an asshole. And, you know, it's like, and so today your points, I thought, you know, I never did hear that class. I heard you allude to it, so I want to talk about that, but here's the email. Mac, awesome to hear General Zinni on All Marine Radio. Could you ask him his thoughts on General Powell? I think that General Powell failed the nation, and I know these are hard words, when he took that information to the UN, because it added his credibility to that ball of garbage that the Bush administration was selling. General Zinni's thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I have the greatest respect for General Powell. I think he was put in a very difficult situation. You know, he signed on to be the president's Secretary of State. The president was committed to this mission despite, you think about what General Powell did to try to save him from this. He went back to the United Nations. He got a resolution getting the inspectors back in who came away saying there was no ongoing program of weapons of mass destruction, which I validate from having worked with CIA on that very thing and knew there was no credible evidence. I think he was given a bunch of facts about what might be out there. He had serious doubts about it. I would say, in short, just from my perspective, his loyalty to his president, to his country, since he knew they were going down this path, that he felt that he had to ride with the president because he signed up for it, and maybe could be a voice of reason down the road. It was tough. If he had resigned and walked away, what would it have done? Beside Iraq, we had Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda, a moment when the country was traumatized. And I don't think deep down inside, although he didn't agree with the course they were going on, he could, as a good soldier, you know, abandon his troops and his unit. I think that's what his thinking was. But I don't want to speak for Colin Powell.
Roger, I understand.
Speak for himself.
You know, you use the word abandon, and it's a word pregnant if you're a military, you know, person, especially if you're a beyond a military person and you're a Marine, because that's something we don't do. Yet General Newbold did. He saw much of the same information, and he made a different decision. And you were outspoken before that. And I will tell you this: my reference to you as a Bernie Bush, being Catholic and all. When the Bernie Bush speaks, so everybody's going to war, and you're reading all this information about this is linked to this, and Al-Qaeda's operating in Iraq, and blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, the Bernie Bush lights off in Salon magazine. Yeah, like, I don't know what planet they're on. I don't know what they're looking at, but I don't see it, and this isn't necessary. So I see that, and I went, uh-oh. If that guy's saying that, then I should probably do some reading. And so we're where we are today in two parts of the world, in not very good situations, because in part generals have agreed with these courses of action and implemented them, and this all can't be laid at the feet of Don Rumsfeld, George Bush, and also Barack Obama. What is the role of a general officer in terms of American policy when you see it going down the road? Because it seems like our general officers are failing us, in my opinion, as a nation. And I say this with pain because, you know, there's more than a few of them that are my friends. Yet there's a greater obligation to the nation because we are where we are with their complicity. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, just a little story. When I was a commander of CENTCOM, General Hugh Shelton became the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, and, mm-hmm. and of course, we had Secretary Cohen, Secretary of Defense. And right after I had taken over, not long, I got this letter and a book in the mail from General Shelton. It was Dereliction of Duty, H.R. McMaster's book about how the Joint Chiefs of Staff let us down during Vietnam. And the note inside the book said to all the combatant commanders, the service chiefs, the chairman was directing us to read the book thoroughly. There would be a meeting in Washington of all the 17 four-stars, and we were going to discuss the book. So I went up to Washington. Shelton's in the room with this was chairman, vice chairman, joint chiefs, all the combatant commanders, service chiefs, including Coast Guard. And Shelton was a big guy. He slammed his fist on the table, and he says, if you read this book, he had H.R. McMaster's then a major talk to us about the book. And he dismissed him and said, this will never happen while I'm chairman. He said, if you have something that's sticking in your craw, if we're doing something wrong up here in your eyes, if you have a disagreement with a policy of this administration, I promise and guarantee you, as does Secretary Cohen, and Secretary Cohen came in and reinforced that, we will take you to see the president. Your voice will be heard. And I got to tell you, there were a couple times when I called them on that, and they delivered. Sometimes things changed, sometimes they didn't. But in each case, the president acknowledged hearing it, at that time President Clinton. Secretary Cohen convinced President Clinton that you need to know these 17 four-stars. They're the guys that are going to take you to war. You better understand who they are. And the president was willing to invest. We met with him several times a year, one-on-one. The only direction we had from the Secretary of Defense and the chairman was make sure it's presidential, but tell him whatever you think he should know. Now, that's the beginning of the kind of environment that allows senior military people to input. You know, if you go to the Rumsfeld, remember, first he stripped away the title commander-in-chief from the combatant commands. I heard from service chiefs that he never even met with the Joint Chiefs to talk about the war as a body. And basically all the decisions were done up there. The Iraq war plan was thrown away. The one, not that I just left, but my predecessor had developed too, we developed, was modified every year, reapproved by the Joint Chiefs every other year, exercised every year, thrown away. Even General Shinseki tried to fight. The numbers were ridiculous because we knew we needed at least 380,000 troops to seal the border, to control the population as we roll back the administration. We knew we needed to think through how we were going to handle the government, their economic system, all the things that ORHA and CPA had screwed up, that we were insisting that some thinking be given to this. Actually, we had based our plan on an occupation, and I was told after I left from the CENTCOM planners they were not allowed to use the O word. It would be a liberation. If you remember the quotes, it'll be flowers in the streets, it'll be a cakewalk. And this was crushing to believe that. And I'll tell you what I think, where I think the generals may have been responsible. First of all, if you're the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if you're the combatant commander, if you're a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you better know what the hell you're talking about when it comes to war fighting. You can't have people up there that maybe got there, not through any fault of their own, but their assignments didn't allow them to, you know, really get down into mud, blood, and beer,
right,
which they need to, because when you stand up and say, Mr. Secretary, your idea of 130,000 troops is a disaster, you're going to find that it's insufficient, and it's going to give birth to a number of things inside Iraq and Afghanistan that are going to haunt us for a long time. Did they have the confidence, the experience, the operational and strategic knowledge to be able to say that? Now, I'm not going to talk about names and people, but the first and foremost, you need a warfighter, not somebody who, you know, made their reputation inside the Beltway. I mean, the inside the Beltway is another world in so many respects, not just in military respects, but people's idea of how to use the military is, uninformed by experience or study of history or study of the operational art. And that's why we get into these troubles. And, you know, generals have to be more forceful. It may come at a point in time, and each general has got to make this decision on their own. When is it a time when you put your stars on the table? I mean, that's a tough decision because one, is it going to be any better if you leave? Might it be better if you could mitigate some of the problems? Is it people to think clearly?
Excuse me for interrupting, but
sure, yeah.
That was that's General Powell's line of logic in terms of, hey, I cannot, you know, I'm not going to abandon my country, even though I disagree with this course of action, because I'm in a unique position to influence events. And I've asked general officers, we're in Al-Anbar in 2004, and all hell breaks loose everywhere. And we don't have enough guys. We're playing whack-a-mole wherever we are. You know this, sir. There's nobody that fights like us. If you want to get it on with the Marine Corps, you are going to pay, and we'll get after it every day. We'll take our lumps, and we'll come right back at you, and it doesn't matter. We're not going away. There's a long line of history behind us that we're all conscious of, and we're not going to lose tactically. And so, but, you know, we go to a village, and the first thing they say is, how long are you going to be here? Are you going to stay? Because the people that used to live in that house, they all got beheaded after you left last time because they helped you.
Right.
And we got told, anybody who goes near you the next time they come will suffer the same fate. Our women, our children, our sons, all of us. And so, but as that went on, in Al-Anbar, we all watched, we all knew it, and then we'd see Don Rumsfeld, punk ass, get up on these press conferences and be condescending and disrespectful to people who asked him fundamental questions. And we, you know, you're living, I would almost liken it to your experience relative to Vietnam. You're living this completely other reality, and you're watching this and going and thinking, we don't have a chance here. Because the guy who's supposed to help us, he won't even admit that it's an issue because he dismissed Shinseki, who was telling him the truth. And you're thinking, how is this ever going to get better? Yet, there was no general that left, Al-Anbar, who went back and said, Senator McCain, I'd like to testify, and then showed up at the testimony, put his stars on the table, and said, gentlemen, I'm here to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and look, we went through this in Vietnam. You win every battle, you lose the war.
Right.
We never took a hard look back. I actually see great similarities. One of the biggest problems we had in Vietnam is the enemy had a sanctuary. Basically, North Vietnam was their sanctuary. They could go back across the DMZ or through Laos and Cambodia, refit, rearm, rehabilitate, come back. The bombing made very little difference. Secondly, we had a government in Saigon that was corrupt as hell. Generals committing one coup after another. And a lot of villagers told me, what do you want me to die for, fight for? Fast forward to Afghanistan. We have a sanctuary in Pakistan and elsewhere. We have a government in Kabul that people aren't going to die for. Fast forward to Iraq. The Maliki government alienated all the Sunnis back there. Syria was basically a sanctuary. I mean, we keep relearning the same lessons or not learning the same lessons as we go on. And any general worth his salt that has studied his profession, that has looked back and reflected on his own experiences, can see the patterns. But are the generals who are sitting in Washington, are they doing that? I mean, it's easy to say this is a careerism move. But is it an uncertainty move? I mean, are generals educated the right way? Are they given the experience the right way? Are they selected for the top positions based on, you know, their experience, knowledge, and understanding of war fighting, or are they there because they politically gotten there somehow? You know, General Shelton's favorite book was Once an Eagle, and I would advise everybody to read Once an Eagle because it talks about two kinds of generals, you know, Courtney Massengale and Sam Damon, and it was a book that hit home and resonated with a lot of the officers that came out of Vietnam, and certainly, you know, again, in this environment.
My guest this morning is retired Marine General Tony Zinni, Vietnam veteran, Somalia veteran, commanding general, or commander-in-chief of CENTCOM at the time when that title was in use, and the special envoy for the Middle East. And if you're a Marine, no doubt have heard of him. If you're a regular person, you've probably heard of him as well. Gracious enough here on a Monday morning to join us. We're talking about what it is to be a general. Yeah, Greg Newbold did it. Nope, and not too many after that. Do you have a reason why they don't, though? Because I will tell you, sir, it pisses me off. I mean, and then the comment, Joe Amos went around and lectured us on moral courage because, you know, some misguided, misled Marines urinated on the bodies, and we know that that's not right. But, you know, there's moral courage that applies to all of us, not just some of us. And so I will tell you, it's really frustrating now. 7,000, you know, young men, which I can't imagine, 58,000 Vietnam. Now we've added another 7,000 young men and women. And for what? Watching current events now, you know, Iraq, you know, we're trying to bail that thing out. But when we bail it out, are we going to hand it to the Iranians, for God's sakes? And now, and then after, you know, Afghanistan, what the hell does that become now that we're going to have to, you know, it looks like either continue that through murky water, or what does that become? And is it all for naught again? And so, why?
Well, you know, I will tell you, if you look at what we're doing now, you know, back in the heyday when we were all invested in maneuver warfare and understanding how we should fight smarter, better, as opposed to being attritionist, I look at what we're doing now, and it is purely attritionist. You know, we're going to fight on the edges with SOF. We're going to bomb them into oblivion. And here's this ragtag outfit called ISIS that has held their ground for over 2 years against the mightiest force in the world, and supposedly the mightiest alliance in the world, who has increased from 16 countries to 30, going on 30 now in the next two, and have lost their ability to fight, and in many cases their political will to fight. And I think we've seen that in some aspects, with exceptions certainly in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And so we got to ask ourselves, you know, NATO, our own military, our military thinking, our lack of a commitment to a strategy. I mean, if you go back to World War II and you think about FDR and his relationship with Marshall, if you think about the Eisenhowers and the Nimitz's and the MacArthurs, you know, when I went to Afghanistan to do an assessment for General Mattis, when I got there in 2010, I realized there were 10 commanders in 10 years. And you know what I saw as a result of that? Especially people, Marines and soldiers were coming back for their second, third, fourth tours. Every time they came back, it was a different war. It wasn't a consistent strategy. Rules of engagement changed. Their operational direction changed. And there was no consistency. You imagine changing out, you know, the Eisenhowers and the Pattons of the world, or the Holland Mad Smiths of the world. You know, we've become a rotational military now, and no one dares challenge a strategy or the absence of one, or doesn't force it or push it or draw it out from our civilian leadership. Our civilian leadership turns over every 4 years. Even an 8-year presidency, basically all the senior leadership in the cabinet goes after four.
Roger.
They don't come in with any education and strategy and understanding employment in the military. You know, and if the military doesn't step up, the question is, where are the marshals, you know? And you can keep resigning and throwing stars on the table. Believe me, I was asked, when would I have done it? I would have done it when Rumsfeld sent the public affairs guy from the White House down to be a spin doctor in CENTCOM. That would have been it. He either goes or I go. I'm not there to do spin. You know, if you want briefings, it would be purely military. I'm listening to CENTCOM briefings that were spin coming out, which were horrible. But that would have been the end for me. You know? And that was even before we got into it hot and heavy.
Right.
But the decision to come out from the civilian leadership shows a real absence in understanding.
At the risk of making this this interview even more depressing than it already is, here's a question that I ask a lot on this program. If I pull a string from Vietnam through Lebanon to Somalia, through Afghanistan, and through Iraq into Syria today, what I see is a nation, and it pains me to use this word, that fails in its use of national power to achieve strategic goals. What have we forgotten? Why can't we do it? Why do we keep, it seems like, committing the same errors over? And this whole concept of winning the peace, that the kinetic peace is, for us, it's the easier peace. The hard part is what comes afterwards with the economics and the governance and those pieces. What don't we understand anymore? Why does it seem that we don't get that peace anymore, sir. That these things take a long time, and our presence is going to be required there for a long time. If you're going to refashion a part of the world, right, to be a more stable, better partner, and that we're willing to do this and commit these American lives and blood to it because of the vision that I ultimately see, and we're going to be there for 30 years, 50 years. We understand that, but this is why this is so important. Why? How have we lost out? Why don't we understand it?
Well, first of all, you know, we used to be a strategic nation. If you look at the period from the end of World War II until the beginning of the Korean War, that to the 5-7 year period, you'll see some of the greatest strategic decision making we've ever done. The Marshall Plan, the creation of the World Bank, the creation of NATO, the 1947 National Security Act that restructured our government. It's like a winner of a sports team changing its game plan. And you'd say, geez, why would you do it? You just won. You're number one. You're the greatest power in the world. But there was enough strategic thinking to know the world was going to change. When the world started changing, when the Soviet Union began to collapse, we stopped thinking we required that. We become a transactional nation. Transactional nation, I see this, it's not just in government, it's in business and everywhere else. I do consulting work on strategic planning and developing strategic design. I've seen studies that estimate less than 4% of leaders in any capacity have a strategic character, can think and act strategically. We go day to day and we chalk it off to it's just too hard. You know, the globalization, the rise of information communication technology, the speed of events, the redistribution of power, the number of issues that are on the table from the environment to instability, you know, to economic issues. It can be so overwhelming that instead of insisting that we take time to think and act strategically, we cop out. I see this in business all the time. You know, where leaders think they only have to worry quarter to quarter to make their numbers. Nobody is even looking at where the company's going to be 5, 6, 7 years down the road. The same thing happens in government. It's all short-term thinking. It's all acting on the day-to-day stuff. It's none of it projects ahead. None of it even can articulate a future that we should be heading toward. And it's a problem that's global. It's certainly within our society. Almost every aspect of our society. In terms of all the elements of power, we still haven't integrated it correctly. One thing you said is the economics, the other things might come after. No, that has to be in place when the first boot crosses the line of departure. You know, you better, you know, when the Marines were going out to Iraq and Afghanistan, I had a call from the MEF commander saying, have we thought of everything? And I said, well, I'll give you two things to think about. Whose side are you supposed to be on when the Civil War starts? Dead silence. The second question I had, who's going to handle the reconstruction of the society that you're about to tear apart once you pull a plug on the regime? And again, dead silence. One general said, well, we were told somebody's going to be following us that's going to handle all that. Bullshit. You know, lessons ought to tell you the military's going to get stuck with that mission. I did assessments in Iraq and Afghanistan. I saw, you know, I'm sitting in a briefing in Baghdad listening to the military brief the running of the recreational swimming pools, the museums, the date palm harvest and providing of pesticides, the little groups that are connecting the different tribes and religious groups to sort out their problems. I counted in my first day 56 things that were non-military, not even close. In Afghanistan, the same thing. Army Brigadier General, one of the best we had, running the anti-corruption task force, so that the PRTs down there, the Provisional Reconstruction Teams, 80% military, not counting security. You know, and the military's not prepared to do that. We don't rebuild nations. You know, we can handle the security aspects of that. But the economic, the political, the human rights issues, you know, all those issues we get saddled with, and we walk away frustrated.
When we were in Al Anbar, I remember, I don't know, shortly after we got there, you know, some major gets sent over to the Iraqi police organization at Camp Ramadi. And, hey, find out what equipment, find out what radios, find out how many vehicles, blah, 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 blah. He came back with a ripped piece of binder paper with names written in pencil, and he said, this is what they have. And I remember General Mattis looked at me and said, vehicles, radios, zero, zero, and weapons, they have a few. And then somebody said, well, what's the plan? Are there more? I mean, there's got to be radios and vehicles and weapons coming. And then somebody else said, there isn't. There's no plan to do that. And I remember just being stunned. Like, what do you mean? Isn't there a ship with all this stuff loaded on it that's someplace in either the Atlantic or Pacific that's en route? No, there isn't. And you know, so to me that's astounding in terms of, you know, we all went through school and got taught about phase four and winning the peace and as you said, thinking about those things and having those lines written into the plan. Yet it just, it seems like we've completely lost that. And how can we ask the American people to give their sons and daughters and not be in it for the peace? I for me, it's immoral. It's awful. You know, you lived it in Vietnam. You know, we're living it now. And it's just like we have a great nation, but we certainly don't operate it as such in terms of our national power. And
you go back to World War II, they were beginning to plan the end states for Germany, Japan, and the Axis when they just began the offensive. I mean, when you weren't even sure you're going to win this war, they were already planning on how they were going to handle that. And again, you go back to men like Marshall who were thinking about this ahead of time. I mean, the Marshall Plan wasn't something that he just came up with at the end of the war. He was looking back at what the mistakes we made after World War One, and looking at not repeating those. You know, you got to win the peace. It's not enough just to win the war. And so we had men that thought like that, that went back to their experiences, that understand their profession of arms. I mean, I think we need to ask ourselves, how do we develop our senior leadership? I mean, what is the path to, if you're not really invested in your profession fully, if you're not really thinking about it, if you're not encouraging all those with you to challenge things and to challenge you, you're not going to come out any better or smarter. You know, if you're always going to do the politically correct thing, if you see the course to success and promotion as through assignments that don't better your profession of arms and your warfighting ability, then you're going to end up with these problems. I mean, somehow, it's behind the scenes, at least, if not publicly, some general's got to be banging on the table and saying, this won't work. You know, General Van Riper is fond of saying that before we even crossed the line of departure, that I told him, you aren't going to find any WMD. I know it. You know, he wrote about it, and I knew there was no WMD program there. The inspectors knew, and the UN inspector, and we had intelligence officers on those teams, too. It wasn't like it was in some alien inspection team. So we already had discredited the causes by, you know. It's ridiculous. So where were our generals at this time? Look what's happening now, where they're accusing CENTCOM of cooking the books on the intel. When I went out to Afghanistan, I couldn't believe the view of the future that the station chief had and ISAF intelligence guys had, who was 180 degrees out. And they just sort of agreed to disagree. You got to be kidding me.
You know, sir, let me ask you about that. It's like in these OPTs, I'm not an Ivy League guy, right? I went to community college in California, but I know up is up, generally, and down is down, and I know bullshit when I hear it. You sit in an OPT to expand the ground war in Afghanistan, and if you read 20 minutes of Afghan history, you'll know that we're trying to create something that's never been created here. Do we understand the timeline for this? And if Germany and Japan are 50-year events, this is 150. Do we understand the implications if we're going to go spread this footprint and attempt to do these things? Okay? And again, I'm not an Ivy League guy. You know, I just play one on the radio, but does everybody get this? And you look at the decisions and you hear the, and you think, like, you got to be shitting me.
Well, I will tell you, my approach to, when 9/11 happened, it's obvious there was one burning objective, get Al-Qaeda.
Roger.
I would have followed the Powell Doctrine, the Weinberger Doctrine, what we did in Desert Storm, overwhelming force into Afghanistan. We would have nailed them at Tora Bora. But we decided to rent an army. It was neat watching top guys agency guys ride around on horses. And what happened when they got to Tora Bora? They bought their way out. They escaped because we didn't put in overwhelming force, which freezes the situation and gets you the chance to really nail the SOBs. We tried to do it on the cheap. What did we do in Iraq? We threw away 10-03-98, which called for 380,000 troops. Why 380,000? Seal the friggin' borders. Control the population as you roll back the regime. Do not disband the army. If they don't fight, you know, keep them in garrison, pay them, retrain them, vet their leadership or change it around. These are all part of the plan thrown away. But this big march up to Baghdad, you know, take the statue down, declare victory, you go on and fly onto a carrier, and it's all over. Except it ain't all over. You know, and you could have seen that coming. You could, you know, it wasn't hard to understand that the ingredients for failure are there. And again, I'll go back to tell you, this all sounds good when you're sitting inside the Beltway and somebody comes in and tells you, some neocon tells you that, you know, we're going to put Ahmed Shalabi on the throne. It's all going to be right. The people are going to throw flowers at you when you come in. And you don't listen to people who've been in this part of the world for 2-3 decades that tell you it ain't going to be that way. I mean, that's exactly what happens. I mean, that's exactly the problem we face. Everybody that comes in's got another damn good idea. You know, no one, it's lack of study of history. It's lack of study of their profession, of their responsible position. Number one is the need for a strategy, which is too hard, so we fail to do it.
Sir, how the hell can we not have a strategy? Ed, first of all, sir, you got a problem, so you'll come back on so we can continue this discussion, yes?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm sitting, if I was sitting there, it's like, because I know Don Rumsfeld's a jackass, right, and I might get fired, and I've got a wife and 4 kids, so I don't want to get fired. So I'm in D.C., I'm in the Beltway, it's like, hey, Mr. Secretary, but I do understand my moral obligation. I completely agree that the march up is going to be great, fewer troops, General Shinseki doesn't know what he's talking about, this is all going to go swimmingly, we'll get to Baghdad, we'll stay there for a few weeks, and we'll, you know, go back to Kuwait, we'll backload, it'll all be good, maybe we'll leave a few guys there just so, you know, we can go in and have American food when we get there. However, what happens if it doesn't go that way? What was the answer to that?
Well, what's
your name? Get his ass out of here. Is that the way, I mean, because that's what happened ultimately.
Well, I think the first thing you've got to do is make your case. I go back to the point is who are the strongest voices wearing uniforms that could make the case? They could walk in and say, Mr. Secretary, all my military experience, all my military education, all my military judgment says this will be a failure. And there were some retired guys saying that. And if you remember, Jim Webb said it was predictable and predicted. And that has to be heard in some way. In the end, I mean, we're going to learn another bitter lesson. I hope the next Secretary of Defense faced with it realizes that you know, going to Baghdad with 130,000 troops and taking down the regime is no big deal. As a matter of fact, every time we did the internal look exercises, the major CENTCOM exercise, the regime was taken down in less than 3 weeks every time. We were looking for something else to do, and that's how we got really invested in understanding what was going to happen with the population, what could come in from outside, you know, what the problems were, which led to a plan that required the number of troops that we had in there. And we tried to force State Department, USAID, and others to get involved in the planning, and they refused. I mean, the game we generated in 1999 up in Washington, Booz Allen Hamilton, was to look at the effect on the ground. With either regime removal by us or regime collapse, it was the same. And it predicted every single thing that happened. It was called Desert Crossing. It's now FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, has it out there. You can go online and get it.
All right, we need to change gears. Because I have a bunch of email I want to get to. Some of it's along this theme. But the first email says this, sir. I'm really enjoying your remarks this morning. Please come back on All Marine Radio so my people they're already targeting me, sir. Question. During your second tour in Vietnam as a company commander in 1970, did you and your Marines sense that we were not going to succeed decisively in that war? Was there pessimism in the ranks at the time? Did it affect combat operations?
I think that, first of all, it didn't affect the Marines. I mean, we had other issues that were impacting morale. You know, that was a time when racial incidents, drugs and all, and no one was immune to that. But I think good leadership, you know, good units with good leadership, that wasn't the major problem. What I saw in my company, which I can, the only thing I can speak for in my battalion, is that the Marines were still motivated. I mean, in the firefights, I never saw them shrink back. I never saw them question. They were beginning to really ask hard questions. When I was wounded, several of my Marines were medevaced with me. When I could get up, after my operation and somewhat recovery, I wandered around the wards looking for Marines, and I had one of my PFCs who had been walking point that day, and I was up on a point when I got hit. And I asked him, or he asked me, where's this going to go? Where are we headed? And that was the kind of questions that I was hearing. Not so much that we got to get out of this place or it's bad. What I was hearing is, how's this going to end? You know, what are we trying to do here? And I think what was accepted, and at least since I had been with the South Vietnamese military, I felt there was a chance that the South Vietnamese military could prevail if we continued to support them. Remember, the first attack by the North Vietnamese, the Easter Offensive, they were beaten back.
Mm-hmm.
When they came back the second time in 75, the problem was we had cut off funding for them.
Right.
The ammunition, the maintenance support, all that wasn't there. Advisors were gone. And so they were a hollow force when they were hit. You know, so we didn't even leave the wherewithal for the South to defend themselves. But even having said that, you know, we should look at what the lessons that Marshall, Eisenhower, and MacArthur left us. It was not enough just to win battles. You had to win the future, and they won it through changing governments. You know, MacArthur was not going to let the same government exist in Japan. He was going to shape it in a way that was acceptable but was modernized and democratized. The Marshall Plan, the same thing in Germany. You know, leaving behind something that is sustainable and won't repeat what we did. You know, the biggest problem I saw in Saigon, Kabul, and Baghdad is the governments in those places were not things that people were going to be willing to die for in the long term. That's probably the number one lesson we should get out of all this. If you're going to go in and we're going to risk our treasure and our casualties and our military, then we ought to have a say on that, on to what kind of leadership is going to be put into place. We accepted the Malikis and the Karzais and the big men, little men, PQ, the whole crew. We repeat the same mistakes and we expect a different outcome. I mean, Einstein once said that if you keep repeating the same process and it fails, that's the definition of insanity.
All right, I said we're going to try to put a positive spin on this, all right?
Okay.
It's getting worse. Next question. Are you in touch with any of the Vietnamese Marines from your first tour? Did they survive the war and the communist takeover?
Yes. It was kind of interesting because for a while, a number of them went into the hills and fought sort of a guerrilla movement, which didn't last long. And we were monitoring the radio broadcasts, you know, through our intel.
Mm-hmm.
And they stopped after a while. And we never heard from them, so we assumed that they'd all been wiped out. Well, many of them were taken to rehabilitation camps and re-education camps, I think they called them. And about 15 years after the war, when the Vietnamese wanted to improve relations with the U.S., they began releasing them. So all of a sudden, and we hold an advisors reunion every year, we have an association, all of a sudden, these Vietnamese Marines that we knew started coming out. It was a very emotional experience for us. I remember when the largest group of them all came and somehow had gotten uniforms made, like their old uniforms, and showed up in Quantico when we was a really a moving time. To the credit of our great nation, many cities like Des Moines, Iowa, San Antonio, and others ran programs for the Vietnamese and brought them in and helped to get them established. One of my closest friends was, we were lieutenants and captains together. He went on to be a colonel and a brigade commander with the Vietnamese Marines. when he came out, I think he went to Iowa, and he would not accept charity. He was doing three jobs. He was pumping gas and cleaning bedpans at a hospital or something else, but he was so grateful for being here, he wouldn't accept charity. What they had done while they were in those camps, the stories were unbelievable. They would take him out for a mock execution every day. They worked to brainwash their kids and family against them, so the reunions were hard and tough coming out. But, I mean, the Vietnamese Marines were the toughest they had. There were not very large units. When I was there, was only six battalions. The battalions were very small, but they were superb light infantry, you know, and lived off the land in many cases. They didn't have seed rations or MREs and fought hard and took a lot of casualties.
Sir, it's 8:30. Do you have a few more minutes?
Yes, I do.
Okay. My guest this morning, General Tony Zinni, a self-described Guinea from Philly. And next email, sir, are you an Eagles, Phillies, and Sixers fan?
Yes, and throw Flyers in there, too.
You know, Dave Haxtell's a friend of mine. Awesome, a guy. I don't know if you've met him, but he's a great guy. Now the coach of the Philadelphia Flyers. So I want to talk to you about post-combat related mental health.
Yes.
You've been living with it since your first tour. And talk to us. First of all, I want to get your thoughts on how it's changed. We have an awareness and services available to us now that you all didn't have. I had Carl Marlanis on, and he was talking to me about, you know, I just thought that my problems were kind of stress-related relative to my job. I never really linked them to Vietnam. So I want to get, and he's a Rhodes Scholar. And, in fact, he tells a funny story about being in Vietnam and up in I Corps, and after a firefight, he said, I've been there a couple of weeks, and I'd kind of proven myself that I was okay. And so we're cleaning weapons, and one of my squad leaders, a Lance Corporal, comes over and says, sir, is it true what they say about you, that you went to Yale and you're a Rhodes Scholar? And he says, yeah, I think his name's Jenkins. Yeah, Jenkins it is. And then he says, Jenkins looks at him and says, sir, you got to be the dumbest fucking Rhodes Scholar on the planet. And he said, I laughed. And he said, you know, you could probably make a case for that. But, you know, just there was no term PTSD. So your thoughts on it and how it's how are we doing okay with it? Is it much ado about something that is a transient condition? Your thoughts on post-combat related mental health?
Well, first of all, I think it's genuine. I think it's real. I think the advantage we have now is we're finally paying attention to it. There's more awareness. There's more trying to understand it. What I saw coming out of Vietnam is those that suffered from it. And I think all of us suffered from it in some way or form, some greater than others. I think what you see now is more support. I think there's more to learn about it. I'm glad that we're seeing a lot of people writing and studying the effects. And you know, one thing that struck me when I went out to do the assessments in Iraq and Afghanistan is when I left there, I got on a plane with a bunch of troops. Basically, within 24 hours, I was home. You know, you go from a battlefield to a warm kitchen in such a short period of time, and you're being beamed into an entirely different world. And how do you deal with that world? I noticed that some of the forces, I think the Brits took their units for a decompression period on Cyprus or one of the islands, and to be with your team, to not be in that environment, really to talk about what you experienced, get it out. I think there are things like that we ought to really look at. You know, this problem's been going on forever. As a matter of fact, in World War II, when Eleanor Roosevelt went out to the Pacific, she was concerned about this, about troops coming home. If you think about at that time, it took a long time to get home because you were on ships, you're still with your unit, or you went back to Australia or New Zealand, then came home. I think one thing to look at is the speed of return. And you know, if you're just thrown from one crazy environment into another, I think that really plays hell with your adjustment. But that's only one aspect. And I'm really happy to see that leaders have really invested the time and to understand and the compassion necessary, because there was a time in our history where if anybody showed these signs, it was seen as something wrong with the person. I'll tell you one thing, just a little story. I ran into one of my corporals from my company when I was back at Camp Lejeune. I was walking down the street, and I saw him, and he was now a slick-sleeved private, and his uniform was all disheveled. He gained a lot of weight, and I went up to him. He was one of the finest corporals in my company. He was a radio operator for my second platoon commander. And this kid was so good that he called in artillery, called in airstrikes. He called in the sit reps that the platoon commander just had to give him a word or two. He knew how to do it. And he, you know, we saw him as making sergeant and, you know, had a great future in the Marine Corps. When I saw him, I said to him, what happened? He said, I couldn't adjust. He said, out there I was somebody. I knew what was going on. I came back here and it, you know, in garrison, it just didn't seem right. So God knows what was going on, but that was my first real time of focusing on this, you know, and seeing the effects. You're thrown into a parallel universe that's so different and screwed up, then you're thrown back into the one you started from, and I'm not sure we understand all that goes on and what people bring into the environment that may add to the problem, too. So I think there's a lot of work still to be done in that, but thank God we're paying attention to it.
Next email. Mac, I'm curious about General Sidney's thoughts on gender integration in the Marine Corps. Much discussed. What does he think, sir?
Well, I would ask the Secretary of Defense this question. If you're so bent on total integration, why aren't the sports teams at the Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, and West Point integrated? Why do we have Title IX, which is a legalized segregation? Why did the Olympics have separate men's and women's sports? Why did you throw away the Marine Corps study that was done and exercise that was done that proved that integrated units don't do as well as all male units? And in the same case, cast doubt on the credibility and honesty of the male Marines, which is defended by the female Marines that took part. You know, answer those questions first, because I think we're going to hurt a lot of high-quality women Marines. We're going to put them in situations that maybe just few can succeed, the numbers aren't going to be great, and are going to create issues and problems down the road. It's not a matter of being against, women in the military or in the Marine Corps. As a matter of fact, they've made great contributions, and I applaud General Neller in wanting to get up to the numbers up. But I think those that want to see them go into the infantry ought to think about one basketball team at the academy, one swimming team at the academy, and see how that works, because I think it's analogous to what we're going to experience. And I'll be branded as a friggin' Neanderthal, I know, but I just, you know, my first tour in Vietnam as an advisor to the Vietnamese Marines, you know, I left there 123 pounds with four diseases, including malaria, mono, hepatitis, dysentery, and everything else. And I just don't know if that can work. My son was an advisor to an Afghan commando company and went through the same thing. This is political correctness gone overboard, and not to take anything away from women. And I'm sure you're going to find a woman that can meet the physical challenges and all that. Will you get the numbers? Will they be as effective as all male infantry units? Are we going to have a different standard? I mean, when I went to basic school, the needs of the Marine Corps came first. You got your MOS assigned to you. You hope you got one of your three choices, but you may not. Are we going to say the same thing now where a woman could be forced into the infantry? Males? Could be. So if the standards aren't going to be the same, we're admitting that there are differences. So I think we've got to answer those questions. Why are we doing this? Is it really going to be disadvantageous? Is it going to handicap women in the smaller numbers or doom a number of them to fail, going through IOC or going through infantry training school or whatever? And we'll see. I mean, you know, I guess the proof's in the pudding. We'll see. But, when we do things that could lessen our combat efficiency, it scares me.
I also think it's a dead end for women in terms of a career choice. You're not going to make a living at, you know, there's not going to be a 40-year-old woman that's going to take 1st Marine Regiment or, 1-1 up those mountains back behind back behind the Horno. It's not going to happen. And so, you know, I don't know. It is political correctness run amok, sir. And I think we're doing our best. And you know, it's interesting talking to staff and COs, and they said, hey, look, we'll handle it. You know, we'll create an environment where if this is being forced down my throat. We'll create a respectful environment and take care of them. But when we go to war, there is no way that we're going to jeopardize the lives of Marines. They'll be A drivers. They'll go to work in company offices. They will not get in the way of what we do because we've written our history with our infantry, and there's no way we're compromising that. Now, if there's other jobs, you know, can they break tread on a tank? Can they hump artillery rounds? The answer to that is no and no. And so, anyway. All right, so I've got another question for you. General officers at political conventions. We've had, I have some really, I had a battle buddy of mine times too, both from Ramadi and Afghanistan. The CEO of 2-8 named Dave Harrell said, you know, Mac, you could put a shotgun to my genitals, and I don't think I could pull the lever for either one of these. And watching this has been extremely painful. Hold on one second. I'll play his audio because he's a Southern guy, and nothing's as funny as when Southern guys actually attempt to be articulate and are really funny. But here he is, Dave Harrell.
It's the last time we talked.
No, not a one. Oop, that's not him. You know
I was going to buy a one, but you're too far away.
That's Eric Hamill. He's interesting. Ever talk to him about Guadalcanal, sir?
No.
Well, you should. He knows a lot about it. Here's Dave Harrell.
Wow. You know, he can do whatever he wants. I agree. However, I would be hard-pressed if you had a shotgun to my genitalia to endorse either one of those candidates.
Profound and profane. All Marine Radio. Should general officers speak at political conventions, sir?
No. And I think general officers have to be careful about, their involvement in politics. I don't think, and again, personal opinion, I don't think there's anything wrong with a general officer, retired general officer, getting called on by a potential candidate to be asked advice. Like, tell me what you think about our military, or what, it's not an endorsement. That, you know, you don't go to that end to say, I'm going to politically endorse you. I did that through several presidential elections for both sides, you know, Republicans and Democrats. I've been asked several times to run for political office. I've turned it down every time at the national and even state level here in Virginia. First of all, I hate politics. American politics suck big time. It's shameful what it's become. But I think general officers have to stay out of it. That was Marshall's warning to all of us. Marshall didn't even vote. He wanted to stay as apolitical as possible. And I think that's important because when you sign up for something politically, you're taking positions that I think in some ways will degrade what you may have to offer in advice. It may be seen as bent toward one side or another. So we should stay out of that as much as we can. I'm not that worried about it. I don't think on the active duty side I've ever seen political statements or attitudes or positions within the active ranks to any great degree. Retired guys may be a little different. It bothers me that we're seeing more and more people begin to get involved in the politics beyond just maybe the operational or strategic advice that they could give. That's an individual choice, and I'm not going to criticize the people who do it, but it would not be for me.
Let me give you my opinion. I'm more comfortable seeing them in public. With giving their public views, even at a political convention, then I am. The other path is then you can go become a consultant sit on the boards and make millions of dollars and be part of, you know, Eisenhower's term, the military industrial complex. I'm way more comfortable with you in public. I can criticize you. I can take or leave what you have to say. And you can marginalize your value in terms of would another administration call you. So I'm more comfortable with them being in the public realm because I do honestly believe, sir, that we have a crisis in terms of general officers and what they contribute to the nation. Most of them are tremendously bright guys, and they're accomplished guys, well-spoken. Do we need more or less of them in our culture? I think we need more of them. Sebastian Younger would say we need more of them, because the military is forming its own subculture because we don't identify with our culture. It doesn't really welcome us back. And so we're forming this subculture, this radio station, a part of that. He said, and we need you back with us because we need what you have. We don't live committed lives. We don't live lives of purpose. We don't look at people and tell them the truth straight up like you do, and the world that you come from tends to do. Your thoughts on that?
But maybe we're confusing two things.
Okay.
One is service to your nation. If an administration calls on you to be Secretary of State or ambassador to the Dry Tortugas or someplace, I think if you feel you can contribute, and that you should. I think that's service to your country. I separate two other things. One is openly politically supporting a party or an individual for political reasons, or taking a political or running for office. Now, I know there are plenty of generals that have run for office, from Eisenhower to many others that attempted to, and last time was Wesley Clark that ran. I don't object to that. Personally, I wouldn't do it. I stood with candidates, like Jim Webb and others, but they were all Marines, and I was standing there for another reason, so it had nothing to do with their particular political party or anything. But I think if you stand up and you take a political position, and in some way then that is articulates an opposition to another political position, you've lessened your credibility, and you've lessened your viability should that other person win and may want to call on you, or may want your expertise. Let's say General Mattis is somebody wants to make him ambassador to the Saudi Arabia, which would be a fantastic idea. If he came out in support of a particular political party, then that other political party, if he gets in, may not say, well, I can't trust this guy. He was opposed to us. He said things about us. He's politically not oriented the same way, even though he has no political orientation. So, I think it's best for generals, it's not a requirement, it's not law, to stay out of the politics side, to provide advice, to offer to serve, I think is fine. The harder choice, which I choose not to do, is to run for political office or to stand up at a political event that takes a political position and takes one in opposition of another political party. I think generals got to be really careful with that.
All right. I have a few more questions. Could you talk about the role of the chaplain? You mentioned that. I found it really interesting advice in your combat concepts presentation, and I want to give you a little my own little vignette. I'm a company commander, an LAR company commander, in 1993. And by the way, we did windows. Okay, Neller was a battalion commander. We did windows at that LAR battalion. Anyway, gonna do a 10-day exercise. I put together a drug deal where LAV test directorate over in Yuma gave me their air defense variant, and it was going to embed with my company as we maneuvered around 29 Palms for the better part of 10 days. I'm getting ready to issue the order at the northern end of Wood Canyon up near Quackenbush Lake, and a huge checks on station that's going to aggress us for during the day so they can do their testing stuff. Flying up Wood Canyon, I think it's a truck. It's ultimately 7 feet off the ground coming up the rotor clips the side of the canyon as it's within maybe 200 meters of where I was in the center of the wadi. My company's all pushed up in the little crevices that contributed to the wadi, and goes nose down. Pilots decapitated, co-pilots crushed to death. The crew chief and a corporal that rode along are fighting for their lives. All four ultimately die. Towards the end of the day, my gunny, guy named Lance Y comes up to me, and I'm sitting on a couple crates of ammunition. We, you know, it's a crime scene now. The coroner hasn't got there yet, so we're still waiting, you know, picking up body parts and all the stuff that you do. And he walks up to me, he says, hey, Skipper, how are you? And I said, I don't really know. I haven't thought about me. Why? He said, he's a big guy looking down at me. He said, you know, you're never going to get over this. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, this is going to bother you for the rest of your life. And he said, I heard what happened today. He said, you know, I heard what went on. He said, just know, you need to know that. And I said, well, I'm not exactly effing sure, but I'm pretty effing sure that the effing therapist doesn't say that to the effing patient right about effing now. So why don't you get the F out of here? And he says, no, you need to know that. I said, where did you get that? He said, I got that from guys that I went through something like this, not like this. He said, but that advice comes from Vietnam. And probably some of the best advice I've ever gotten, because whenever it has bothered me, and it does, there isn't a week that doesn't go by that I don't think about Sergeant Peter Bazzarini, who, you know, you're watching him struggle for his life, you're trying to help him live, he's trying to live, and nothing's working, so you go through that horrible experience. And I gave that advice in Iraq, and a chaplain came up to me, and he said, are you Major McNamara? And so I covered my name tape, and I said, maybe, why? Do I owe you money? He said, no. He said, are you the one that tells Marines that they're never getting over this? And I said, yeah, I tell them that. I said, you got a problem with that, chaplain? And he said, no, I think it's great advice. And I said, well, you know, I've given it some thought. I think that is mental health in terms of the oral history of the Marine Corps. That came from Vietnam. Where do you think they got it? Probably Korean World War II Marines that were still in that were telling them that you're going to struggle with this and don't feel bad when it reaches out and grabs you. You're just going to be different. Where did those guys get it? Probably from guys who fought in Latin America and in France. And I said, so that's very much the oral history. I don't know anything else but that because I've never had any classes. So I'm curious about your thoughts on the chaplain and how you mitigate this stuff while you're in combat.
Well, two things there. One is the chaplain. The other is how do you handle, you know, especially people who are experiencing casualties, deaths, and for the first time. Despite having lost troops in combat and having units that's just seen a lot of horrible, horrific things in combat, probably the worst experiences that I went through with losing troops in peacetime. I mean, in units that I've commanded, I've had three helicopters go down that we lost troops in three different events. One of them, I was the MEU commander, and it was a battalion that had suffered several unbelievable accidents before that. One had mortar rounds back at their home base go astray and killed a bunch of their troops, and had another event where some troops were killed. So this was the third event, and the helicopter went down, lost about half the troops on it. Fortunately, it was a platoon that was the super swimmer, so about half of them got out. And they really were crushed by it. And even the sergeant major and the battalion commander, we were board ship, and they were talking about possibly we should cancel the exercise. This is traumatic. And I said to them, here's what we're going to do. We're going to spend one day grieving. This is after we did the search and everything else. Okay. We're going to spend one day grieving. There'll be a ceremony honoring those that we lost. And then the day after that, we continue the exercise. And I said, I will be on the first helicopter off this platform as we continue the exercise. I had one of the first sergeants come up to me and said, sir, you can't do this. We're just, the battalion is just too shocked and shocked from everything that happened and too down. They need time to grieve and recover. I said, we're Marines. If this happens in combat, you got to pick it up and go. We will honor them. We will grieve for them. Day after tomorrow, we're back on his helicopter. He came up to me during the exercise a couple days later. He said, thank you. Thank you for reminding us that we're Marines and we had to get through this. You know, we had to deal with this. So, you know, when you see something like that, you've got to help put it in perspective. But you can never lose sight that it can't crush you and it can't crush the unit, because they're going to find times when they go through that. And I've seen that. I mean, I've seen it in, where the losses are horrific, where a key leader is killed, and like everybody else, I've seen good chaplains and bad chaplains. I had a great chaplain when I was a company commander in Vietnam. He wanted to be up front, you know, he didn't care about the threats and the dangers. When I was a battalion commander, I had a phenomenal chaplain. He came in as young. We called him the combat chaplain. He was always cammied up. He was out on patrol. At, using his own money, if one of our troops had a mother or a father that passed away or died, he flew out with the troops to their to their home, you know, and went with them. You know, he insisted on doing that. He went on liberty with the troops, you know. A couple times ago, he worried me, but, you know, he was one of them. I mean, and they loved him. They just constantly went to him with issues, and he was, in my mind, one of the strongest elements of our leadership in the battalion. And I would meet with him every week and say, Chaplain, without naming names or anything like that, I don't want to violate the, you know, your code.
Your Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah, whatever it is, but you know, he was a priest too, so I had to tell him. I said, but tell me what I need to know. And in very general terms, he would be able to let me know things that I might not have known or the chain of command might not have known, because he approaches them and talks to them in a different way. And so in a way, it was not only helping me understand my battalion, he's helping me be a better leader too. Not to get off the subject of the chaplain, but I was blessed when my first platoon, I had a platoon sergeant, was a Korean War vet, decorated, you know, a tough piece of leather. And the first time I walked through the door, he got me aside, says, come on in the office, Lieutenant, welcome aboard. Second thing he said to me, I got two jobs. One is to make sure everybody in this platoon meets your standards and is ready. He said, the second is to help you become a better officer. If you'll allow me to do that, you know, I will, you know, give you everything I have from my experience. The most valuable experience I could have had as a second lieutenant. And this chaplain was doing the same thing, you know, mm-hmm. different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think when chaplains are committed, you know, unfortunately we see instances where we have older chaplains, we have chaplains that are burned out, we have chaplains that are not motivated toward the military side.
Right.
But, you know, when you see the really good ones come down that, you know, make your eyes water, you see how much more that contributes to the morale, the leadership, you know, to the whole ability of the unit to do its mission more effectively.
General Tony Zinni concluding our time with us, and we've taken up a bunch of it this morning, and so we appreciate it. Thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. One more email, and then I've got about three little interesting questions. But the email says this, Mac, could General Zinni give us a thumbnail in terms of the way ahead against both ISIS? And then also, I'd be curious to hear his thoughts upon the conclusion of the event, or at least getting it under control in Syria. What are his thoughts? How do we not allow Iraq to fall into Iranian / the Persian Empire again? And then two, could he give us the way ahead? Were he queen for a day in Afghanistan? So do you want to give us your thoughts on both of those in terms of the way ahead?
Yeah. Well, in terms of ISIS, I think...
And Iran.
Okay. In terms of ISIS in Syria, I think we've allowed ISIS too long to sit and own property. It's ridiculous. I think we should invoke Article 5 of NATO. We've been attacked. France has been attacked. Belgium's been attacked. You know, Turkey's been attacked. You name it. And insist that we take this on with ground troops. I think and I know this for a fact, that many of our allies in the region there would join if they knew we would provide the support and we were committed to this. I think a NATO operation coming out of Turkey and out of off the Mediterranean, with allies, with our support, allies coming up through Jordan, we would crush these guys in a matter of, you know, a couple of weeks. And the idea of them owning terrain, having a capital at Raqqa and all that, we could eliminate. Now, it doesn't mean they're not going to have little cells around, but I think you would help yourself by cutting radicalization around the world, making heroes out of these guys by, you know, in the eyes of losers, by just nailing them and crushing them, which we could do. What we don't understand, it would take fewer casualties. And Desert Storm proved that. When you could put commit overwhelming force, you know, look at the casualties we take now. I mean, there are civilian casualties, whether it's San Bernardino, Orlando, you know, Paris, or wherever. So that would be the military side of this, and I think the Arab coalition would work with the moderate resistance inside Syria. I would demarsh the Russians and the Assad government, saying you cease all military operations, you can hold the terrain you have, but you're not to be involved in this. I would also at the same time convene a group based around the UN Security Council as the core on negotiations for the future of Syria. And here, which would include Iraq, I'd look at different solutions. I don't know that you can put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Iraq, Syria, all these places are Sykes-Picot artificial creations that came out of World War I. I would look for different models. They understand Emirates. Look at the United Arab Emirates. Maybe it's a time when we have a Kurdistan or we have a Sunnistan or something like that, where each of these groups, ethnic and religious, have some sort of semi-autonomous or relatively autonomous entity within a much looser confederation or federation. But open it up to not going back to that kind of thinking. In a way, that diminishes the Iranian influence because of you would get the Sunnis and Christians and others that don't lean that way to create their own capability. And I think each side has a sponsorship. I don't think you're going to change the Shia parts of Iraq now. They are going to be influenced by Iran, and Iran's going to be seen as a sponsor. The Sunni pieces in both Syria and Iraq, I think, ought to look to the Arab Sunni leadership on the peninsula, like Saudi Arabia and UAE and Kuwait.
Roger.
And then the Alawites and the Christians and the others that tend to cluster together, that may be something that the Russians will have an interest in. We will work with the Kurds and others that we have been basically tacitly sponsoring. So each would have a connection and a protector, if you will. There can be some sort of federated system in there that can pull them together, and so there might be something called an Iraq or a Syria, but it would look different. It would ensure revenue sharing, decision making, much more of it is shared, which was a fault of Maliki, which got us into this mess, or one of the reasons that added or exacerbated it. So, you know, it may not be the perfect answer. It may take different ways of looking at it, but I think what we're doing now, this kind of slow attrition with no direction for the future, isn't going to get it. And so I don't know why the most powerful nation, the most powerful alliance in the world, allows these guys to sit there for 2 years, you know, owning terrain. You know, and the belief that you get casualties by committing overwhelming ground forces is ridiculous. That's how you minimize casualties. We're going to end up with more casualties if you count what we suffer militarily, what we suffer in civilians getting blown up all around the world, in the end than we would have if we'd gone in and with a couple of brigades took these SOBs out.
Does the airstrike number that gets quoted almost daily remind you of the body count number in Vietnam?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a body count mentality. I mean, look, CENTCOM's got egg on their face on this rosy picture. If you start out adding up supposedly how many we killed, you know, we should have run out of ISIS fighters a long time ago. These are ridiculous. It's like pacified parts of Afghanistan, which are ridiculous. I mean, we don't even understand Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a country. It's Punjabs. It's Tajiks. It's all tribal. In my mind, I would have gone in overwhelming force, as I said before, nailed the hell out of Al-Qaeda and gotten out. The Taliban didn't attack us. I mean, our beef with the Taliban is they housed and gave sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. Once we took them out, give the Northern Alliance weapons or whatever they need. If they want to kill each other for the next century, fine. They were not reaching out to try to touch us in any way. We were not going to make that a Jeffersonian democracy and a free market economy and kumbaya, human rights all throughout that place. I mean, that was ridiculous to think we could afford to do it or could do it. It's the arrogance and the hubris we have in doing that. You know, that all around the world we're going to be the force that comes in and changes your society. society and moves it from the 10th century to the 21st. I mean, patently ridiculous. When I read the manual on counterinsurgency, which was ridiculous, I can't believe we resurrected COIN, right up front it said what you needed in the way of forces and treasure and everything else you needed to make it happen. And when you looked at the forces that the presidents of the last two administrations were willing to give you, it doesn't add up, you know? I mean, and the worst thing we did is the military. This is where we make a big mistake. In the absence of a strategy, we develop one. We develop COIN as the be-all, end-all. And that got us in more trouble, created more casualties, cost us more money, and more reputation than anything else that we did.
The our center of gravity, is it still our the American public watching? I won't say still. Your thoughts on our center of gravity, because it would seem to me overwhelming force is necessary for the United States, because we have to stop the kinetic pretty quick. Because I don't know a free people on the planet that can sit and watch the video that comes in of combat. I don't care if it would have been from of Way City or Sharpsburg or Iwo Jima. There's not too many free countries that will watch that year after year after year and at some point not put their hand up and say, you know what, this is bullshit, this is enough. So knowing that you've got to make the kinetic stop relatively quick in an endeavor that you're going to embark on for your own national security and in your own national interest, it would seem to me that knowing the American center of gravity, you would protect that by saying, we need to go big. We need to go, you know, and we need to get there in a hurry. We need to cool this place out relative to kinetics so that we can begin the process of creating, you know, of winning the peace, if I could. It would seem to me that we would understand that and that overwhelming force would be simply a part of the way we know we've got to do business here, but it just doesn't seem like anybody gets it.
Yeah, you know, when we say overwhelming force, it's not only overwhelming military power.
Roger.
It's also overwhelming international support. In other words, we build and create the coalitions that go there. And believe me, they'll go if we lead. It's applying whatever we need economically, diplomatically, and everything else, but it, within the context of a sane strategy and knowing the limitations of what we can and what we can't do. Overwhelming force to try to minimize the violence as much as you possibly can. I think then if you're going to make the hard decision to commit to restructure the society, there's no option for those on the ground. It will be done in the way we say it will be done if we are investing in it. In other words, this is MacArthur in Japan. This is Eisenhower in Germany. There wasn't going to be any corrupt guy standing up saying, okay, I'll work with you while I take all my kickbacks and screw the people. And so a Westmoreland sits in Saigon watching these generals, you know, commit coup after coup, screw the people, and it's all okay. Or we sit in Baghdad or Kabul watching the same thing. Look, when I was in Afghanistan, I flew over this compound that I couldn't believe. It was like somebody took it out of Las Vegas or something and put it in the middle of the desert. And the guy was flying a helicopter, said, that's Karzai's brother. You know, supposedly they were involved in, the opium trade or whatever, I don't know. But the corruption was obvious around where you could see it. I know when they were trying to clean out the poppy harvest, he would pick which ones that could be taken out, which ones couldn't. People see that. And so we're bullshitting ourselves about democracy and getting rid of corruption, and it's right there in front of their face. So if we go in and we eliminate the threat, especially the threat that can be external, and we do it internally, then they're going to have to accept the way we're going to reconstruct that government and their social structure.
Or else don't go.
Or else don't go.
Okay.
Or else just go like we should have in Afghanistan, take out Al-Qaeda, then, you know, here, Nate, give the Northern Alliance military support, but they got to sort it out themselves. You know, and the idea is we will not accept anything that goes external outside the border, especially that can touch us or our allies, but we're not going to invest in you, you know, unless it's done our way.
So in the world of Zinni, we go in overwhelming force, we kill Osama bin Laden up in the Tora Bora, and then we leave. We don't go to Iraq. The world's a little bit different place right now.
I would say here, just to put a little more definition on that, Afghanistan, I would support the Northern Alliance,
Roger.
You know, so the Taliban don't get a free ride in trying to come back, but they can sort it out. It's their problem, their issue, and again, as long as it doesn't go outside. In terms of Iraq, I would not have gone in, but I think there's a couple steps you could have taken. One, we got the inspectors back in, which is fine. Two, I would have made this, much like we did Kurdistan, but we didn't do in the south, I would have made the Shia areas in the south a no-drive zone. In other words, demand that that the five divisions that Saddam had there leave and go back to the Sunni center. They were not allowed in there. One of the reasons why Iran had so much influence is the Marsh Arabs and the Sunnis, the Shia in the south, felt that we helped the Kurds 100%. We only gave them about 10%, a no-fly zone. And so they went to Iran. We would have provided the same kind of protection in the south as we did. Saddam would be leading a rump state of just the Sunni parts. And going back to my thoughts about emiratization, that might be the beginnings of how that might have ended up down the road, but not without all the costs and the bloodshed.
All right, sir. Give me a leader that you've I took your advice that night that you did Combat Concepts. You, one of the things you recommended was pick a battle, and it doesn't matter from when in history, but pick a battle, learn everything you can learn about every aspect of that battle, medical, logistics, communications, operations, tactics, strategy. I took that advice. And oddly enough, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Iwo Jima. So I want to ask you a quick question about that. Your thoughts on the renaming of the people in that image. Tremendously, I found it, kind of riveting history come back alive again. But your thoughts on that. I know you're a fan of the battle.
Yeah, I am. I spent a lot of time on the island because I used to take the battle study programs out there when I was in the 3rd Division. What I looked for in that battle was, even though it's hard to see, is where maneuver came into play. And maneuver wasn't grand maneuver. It was minimal. It was tactical. But it was interesting. If you look at what when they sent 3rd Division ashore in the center, when you looked at like 9th Marines, which is close to my heart, obviously,
right.
You saw Grace B. Erskine in what he used to. He kept shifting, like he put all the mortars in one battalion, and then he'd move them around again. And every time one of the units even got a small penetration or created a small salient, he flanked. Instead of looking at it at 30,000 feet, a battle like that, because I don't think you see much at that, maybe the high operational end, look down at the tactical level and look at where, even in terms of short distances, you were seeing more innovation, more maneuver, more thinking. When they were told there would be a night attack, the first reaction was night attack. We haven't done that. Where are we going to attack? When? And the commander says, I don't know when. There'll be one night attack because we haven't done it. It'll be a surprise, but we'll choose the moment. And it turned out the night attack was so successful that they could have kept on going, but they didn't know what to do. But it turned out to really break the back of the last really defensive position. So, in battles like that, it's important to look for things at tactical level. But let me give you another way to look at things. I like to look at campaigns. Campaigns that people don't pay attention to that are really significant. I think Washington's campaign in New Jersey in the winter was the most significant operation of the war, or the most significant campaign of the war, because he had been defeated in New York. The Brits were confident of victory. They went to hold up in the winter. And when he ran that campaign, attacks on Princeton and Trenton and all that, and in miserable weather with no logistics, hit and run, what he did is he shocked the British, and they began to believe they could lose this war. He certainly took the Hessians out of the war. And he bolstered his own morale, not only in his units going through Valley Forge and everything else, but also local morale. So everybody said, well, Saratoga, everybody looks for a battle as a turning point.
Right.
I thought his campaign, especially coming off conventional defeat, was most significant. I think in the Civil War, the most significant campaign, which doesn't get a lot of attention, is Sherman. Sherman understood what needed to be done. He did not go for headlong attacks into fortified positions. He flanked, he enveloped, and he did it consistently. He cut supply lines. He brought the war home to the civilian population so that their support waned. And when you look at it, it was the most strategically and operationally, I think, brilliant campaign of the Civil War. And Grant understood that. And for the first time, did something the Confederates couldn't do, Robert Lee wanted to do. He tied the Western campaign with the campaign in the East. So I think it's important to look at campaigns like that and where they worked, where they really worked well. You know, unfortunately, when you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, and maybe it's too early, we've got to look back, it's hard to see, or even now in Syria, where we're going to find something like that. I mean, what we have now, we've sort of ended up in an attrition kind of campaign. You know, I think one of the greatest things that has come out of Iraq and Afghanistan is the evolution of SOF. I'm really impressed with SOF becoming much more serious, much more integrated in the conventional operations. The leadership has been really impressive. But I think we've fooled ourselves into thinking SOF is, you know, wins wars. It doesn't. SOF wins strategic firefights. Firefights that you absolutely are going to rescue a hostage. You're going to hit a high-value target. You're going to gain some strategic reconnaissance. These are strategic firefights, and you need highly trained, specialized troops to do it. But they are firefights. You know, you can't win a war without winning major battles and campaigns. You know, there's only one way you take control of terrain and people, and that's through ground forces. And, you know, this whole stupidity of boots on the ground, which the civilians can't even define, but now it's become a term of art. You know, BOG, believe it or not. You know, it's unbelievable.
Well, no, I mean, what we got sold, sir, was small numbers, the special forces guys zooming around at night, whacking them, and that's how we're going to achieve our strategic goals for the nation. And
I think it's
a joke.
I think you can achieve strategic objectives where a strategic firefight, highly skilled people are required. I think taking out, you know, strategic leaders, I think if it's necessary to rescue hostages, do things that have exponentially more impact than what you're committing or what the size of the fight is. That's why we created them, and they do a great job. But you don't win wars that way. I mean, the Germans said that. The Germans said that in the beginning of the war, when they were winning, the Brits were reduced to raids, you know, in Dieppe and other places. That toward the end of the war, when the Germans are losing, this is Otto Skorzeny and the commandos, that it means you're not winning battles anymore or campaigns.
Okay, some quick questions, and then we'll let you go. A leader that you admire in history, not necessarily military, that you enjoy reading about?
Easily George Marshall.
Give us a book about Marshall that those of us who haven't read enough about him could read.
Read his memoirs.
Okay.
It's him talking, but there's a book now, I can't remember the author, I read it a couple months ago, that really compared Patton, MacArthur, and Marshall. I think it really, you know, really brought out the strengths that Marshall had. He was a true strategist and really understood conflict beyond just the tactical or operational sides.
Give us a book to read.
A book to read?
Not necessarily about Marshall, but just a book that you've read or would recommend here for those of us looking to read something.
I think that there's a couple books out now on Hamilton, which I really enjoyed. They're the latest things I'm reading. And there's another book that I'm almost through. It's called The Secret War. It's a really thick book, but it's the history of all the intelligence organizations in World War II, all sides. And it was an eye-opener in terms of how effective or ineffective intelligence really was and how commanders really didn't understand it, misused it, didn't trust it, or in some cases did, and what it was able to deliver and not deliver. So those are a couple of things just recently that I thought were good. I like me about it, I guess, a year ago when it first came out. I thought that was really insightful.
Favorite food?
Favorite food?
Yes.
Probably, well, Italian. I mean, everything Italian.
Come on, you can't, I'm not going to give you that, let you off that easily. What Italian?
Cacciatore. I make great chicken and cacciatore, which basically I make a great tomato sauce and marinara sauce, and I throw all kinds of stuff in there and cook it up.
So for those of us that aren't Italian, when you're dating an Italian girl and she makes the sauce for you, is that a big deal?
It's a big deal. I didn't marry an Italian, so, you know, that's
you're making your own sauce?
I make my own sauce, yeah.
but if you are dating an Italian, I didn't realize what a big deal that was when she makes the sauce for you. That's a big deal, evidently, yes?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. You ever see the scene from The Godfather when they go to the mattresses and they're cooking the sauce over the stove and they're smelling it and they're dipping the bread in it? When I saw that movie with my brother, he said, I can smell it in the movie. And I said, you're right. You know, I can smell it, too.
Favorite musical act or band, group, individual? Who do you like?
Yeah, Four Seasons. One of those guys is from there where I grew up.
Really? The Four Seasons. All right, sir, first of all, I can't say thank you enough for doing this. I've enjoyed every second of it. And first of all, our mission is post-combat related mental health. I told you that we talk all things Marine, and then when they're not paying attention, we bait and switch it and talk post-combat related mental health. In the hope that guys who listen will spread the gospel, you know, this stuff isn't easy. We all live with it, and if you need help, put your hand up. We're a unique tribe. We'll always come and help. But your words today and you coming on here help that effort. So thank you very much.
Okay, semper pi.
All right, thanks, sir.
Take care.
That is General Tony Zinni. More of All Marine Radio coming up next here on the All Warrior Radio Network.